Welcome back to Ashburton. We're about ready to start now.
It's Political Commentary.
This morning with Professor Jennifer Curtin. Morena, Jennifer. How are you?
Morena, I'm good, thanks, Rachel.
Hey, let's start by talking about what's going on with Scott Morrison's visit to New Zealand. This is, of course, the Australian Prime Minister. There's been a lot of big topics on the cards for discussion, but the relationship with China between both New Zealand and Australia has been quite a hot-button topic. What, I guess, are some of the big takeaways from the conversations that have been had this week?
Well, I think we have to realise that, yes, China was definitely part of the conversation, but it wasn't the only part. I think why we've ended up partly focusing on that to such an extent is partly because of the 60 Minutes program and the talk up around this as the primary issue before Morrison arrived. And it's true that Australia does its politics and its rhetoric with China in a different way to what we do. Theirs is much more gung-ho, much more likely to invoke, you know, terms like war and so on. We tend to be softer in our language, but it doesn't mean that actually really on those issues around trade and human rights, there's probably not that much difference. It's a matter of degrees. It's a lot about how these two leaders present themselves to their domestic audiences, as well as to the rest of the world, and of course to China.
So, if this has been one topic that I guess has dominated the media, what are some of the things we might have missed from the conversations that have been had this week between the two countries?
Well, I think the language around the region was more broadly important. So we saw Scott Morrison in the final communique talk about ANZUS, whereas Ardern's talking more about ANZAC, and the place of the US in this conversation is quite important. Australia also talks about the Indo-Pacific, and what we've heard from Dame Meg Taylor, who's the outgoing Secretary General of the Pacific Islands Forum this week, is that allowing Australia to, well, she wasn't quite this specific, but allowing this narrative of, or the description of the Indo-Pacific being used often then leads to a forgetfulness on the part of bigger states about the role of the smaller Pacific Island states. So who's looking after that region and how are we including them in that conversation? But Ardern also did talk about the 501s to Scott Morrison, and what we saw in the communique is even though that was put to one side and no resolution was made about how to manage deportations, we did see a shift in the visa pathway to citizenship for New Zealanders who are living in Australia. So up until now, it's been like a four-year wait, earning a certain amount of money each year to qualify for citizenship. Morrison's government has now shifted that down to 3 years.
So that's, I guess, like quite a significant change and something that I think has probably been a part of this conversation for quite some years. The 501s thing is interesting, though, because that's been another topic that I guess has dominated media coverage of the Australia-New Zealand relationship. What are we seeing around the refugee conversation? Because that's been a different part of this whole picture, particularly around the offer from New Zealand to resettle 150 refugees from offshore detention. Are we seeing any movement around that, or was that something that was particularly discussed this week?
Oh, no doubt it was discussed. It didn't, from what I saw, appear in this very long communique of 51 points or something that they released. I think the thing we have to remember is that Peter Dutton and others in Morrison's cabinet are really strong on this border protection, homeland security thing that they do. And while we think it applies a lot to us, you're right, it's the refugees and the and Rebecca, I would just do a shout out to Rebecca Holt's continuing investigative journalism on this. She's a New Zealander in Australia and people can find her on social media. But this policy they see, the Australians see, as a domestic policy, and trying to get them to shut down those offshore detention centres and treat refugees and asylum seekers more humanely is a really challenging one, and I don't think New Zealand and the Prime Minister would have had any leverage, especially since they're going into an election campaign fairly soon. We're expecting an election before November, so that's early. And they love running on these kinds of wedge politics issues against Labor in Australia.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what's been happening for the National Party here in New Zealand this week. We've seen two, I guess, quite high-profile resignations or retirements. Nick Smith, who's been an MP for 30 years, has retired this week, announced his retirement. And this has all kind of been in the wake of some conversation around a verbal altercation, which hasn't really been explained more beyond that yet. But that has been quite a significant moment for the National Party this week. And then yesterday we've also seen that National candidate Jake Besant has cut ties with the party following some serious allegations which have been emerging around his conduct with an ex-partner. Now, this is not necessarily a very good media week for the National Party. Is it pointing to a bigger problem within the party itself in terms of culture, or is it just a bad coincidence? What's your take on this, Jennifer?
Well, a couple of years ago, the Francis Report came out, which delved into the parliamentary workplace culture, and we know that so in the case of ministers or ex-ministers and MPs as bosses behaving badly, and that this is actually rife. So there has been some initiatives taken by the Parliamentary Services Unit to try and develop more training and professional development programs for new MPs and so on. But really, there's not, you know, a lot of people aren't surprised, it seems, by Nick Smith's resignation, potentially for this reason of not being a well-behaved boss. The challenge for the parliamentary services and managing the parliamentary workplace more generally is that these people are not, as managers, their boss is the political party for whom they work. And they're accountable to their electorate. So it muddies the water in terms of who gets to investigate and who gets to hold these people to account. I think more broadly, the Jake Besant example shows that all political parties, but at the moment the National Party, really needs to think about the job description that they put out there for candidates and how they're going about their selection processes. Are they using due diligence and checking out not just whether these people have a sordid background or, you know, don't meet the high level of integrity and ethics we'd expect, but also what kinds of skills do MPs actually need to be able to go on and be ministers and do that kind of work really well? And it seems like, you know, a lot of political parties just aren't getting that right at the moment.
Well, let's touch base briefly on what's happening in Canterbury. Of course, there's been terrible flooding and we're just sort of starting to get a scope of what the longer-term fallout from that's going to be since the rains stopped and we're seeing flood waters subside somewhat. What are you expecting we're going to see from the government in terms of a support package or some sort of announcement around recovery for the region?
Yeah, this is, at the moment, it's been rather we see different announcements sort of each day in terms of what's being offered. So we know, like, PharmAc is making it easier to dispense with drugs. There's money gone into mayoral relief funds to help out. There's MSD packages and MPI packages and new money for farmers. But what we know from scientists is that even though it's been called a once-in-a-hundred-year flood, the nature of climate change and other ways in which we measure these things, like how often they come, and the assumptions behind those, no longer really work. And so thinking of this as just a one-off and then having sort of some kind of, oh, well, this triggers a state of emergency, now we'll get the money out, might not be the best approach going forward because we might be seeing more of these due to a range of factors relating to climate change. And, of course, this one had the higher sea levels, the spring tide from the supermoon. There are a whole bunch of other conflating things. But at the moment, while the government looks responsive, it doesn't look cohesive in its responsiveness. And you do wonder whether or not they need to be thinking about other ways to anticipate these kinds of events given climate change.
Well, thank you very much for your time this morning, Professor Jennifer Curtin. It's always great to have you on the show. I hope you have a lovely rest of your week, and we'll talk to you in a couple of weeks' time.
Kia ora. Thanks, Rachel.
You just heard a bit of political commentary.
With